Aw, yeah, baby. It's almost Valentine's Day. So we're going to be doing some sexy talk right now in this podcast. So yeah, I'm going to scatter some rose petals over your D&D books. I'm going to put on a sexy soundtrack. Maybe Alien 3. I'm going to fetch the Mountain Dew flavored lubricant. And I'm going to get my most erotic of dice. Sexy D6 with a naked lady on the one.
George, are you feeling okay?
Yeah, baby, I'm just doing what you asked me to do. You asked me to tell people there was sexy content coming.
No, honey, I asked for a content warning about sex.
Which is not the same thing.
No.
So should I switch the music off?
Yes, please. Just get out of the way. Right, I'll do this one. Ahem. For our Valentine's theme episode, we want to talk about love, sex, and relationship in games. This episode will not feature anything explicit or overly graphic, but it should still come with a content warning of sexual themes for anyone who isn't comfortable with that sort of thing, or simply isn't in the mood to listen right now. There will also be discussions about pregnancy, sex work, sexism, homophobia, and transphobia.
And also, I will be doing a sexy voice.
No, you will not be doing a sexy voice. But you can leave the rose petals. Hi, and welcome to another episode of Till Dice Do Us Part. I'm Ailsa.
And I'm George. And we've got some more lovely segments of excitement and adventure for you this time.
Begging your pardon, Lady Ailsa.
Oh, hi, Mailer Demon.
I bring another delivery of communiques for you. I know this is a busy time of year for you.
Oh, thank you very much. Oh, there's so many this year.
Should I be worried about how many Valentine's cards you're getting?
They're not all Valentine's cards, George. I've got here some lovely fan mail from our listeners. Because it's the Valentine's episode, we want to start by having a little bit of a love-in and saying thank you to all our listeners who sent us in some lovely feedback. It really means so much to us when you leave comments or reviews. It really helps us to go up the rankings on the podcast apps, and it helps other people to find us and have faith in us and to listen as well. So we really can't thank you guys enough.
And it gives our ego a good hard stroking.
I mean, that too, yeah. I mean, for example, Simon on Facebook calls us fun, thoughtful, and thought-provoking, even to an old grognard who's been role-playing since the last millennium and seen far too much. Great stuff, comes highly recommended.
That's right, and Jeroen says, we have great chemistry together that distills through the podcast into your ears in such a way that listening to them is almost as fun as actually playing a game. We have chemistry. That's convenient, isn't it?
I mean, you'd hope so after like a decade and a half together. Lord of the Moon gave us 5 stars on Podcast Addict. This podcast is an awful lot of fun and a good listen to anyone with a passing or greater interest in tabletop RPGs. They have a fun, engaging conversational style and are easy on the ear. I mean, I think George is pretty easy on the eye as well. Oh, that might be just me.
Thank you.
It's definitely just you.
We also got a few comments from more beginner people as well as long-term players. So Jason, who said, I know literally nothing about RPGs, but I really enjoyed it. You guys are adorable. Each segment runs a good length of time without dragging on. As a former big metal fan, I'd now like to give Umlaut a go.
Stephen also said that he's found out about some games he never would have looked at, but would now play Umlaut and Night Witches. He really appreciated the episode on inclusivity in role-playing games, especially the part about it's not about being politically correct, it's about making people feel included.
And 2 different people, Lorraine and Duncan, both left a comment saying that they were particularly interested in Night Witches, both the game but also just learning more about that particular point in history, which, as we mentioned, had been a little bit airbrushed out for a few decades.
Cassie told us that she'd love to buy some she-dice. I'm not sure how to break it to her that they're not actually real.
Of all the things I thought we were going to have to do as a time for this podcast, are we going to have to get pink dice made?
Oh, and there's one extra one here, but it's not a letter. It's a slightly soggy card
Oh, let's see. Written in crayon, it says inside, roses are red, violets are blue. Anything you post, I'll retweet for you. And it's signed with a question mark. The question mark is misspelled.
Oh, you got a little admirer, George.
Moving on from that mystery card for a second. On this episode, we have got a section talking about sex and relationships in role-playing games, how to use them in your world building, and how to incorporate the concepts into your games.
Also got another quiz, this time where I'm in the quiz master's chair, the quiz mistress's chair, you might say.
The worm has turned, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm sure whatever sponsor we've got for this week will be appropriately romance themed.
Okay, so on with the episode.
So in this episode, we'd like to have a discussion about how you can include sex and relationships in your games in a fun, healthy way.
So first question is probably, why would you want to include those topics in your game in the first place? Surely your players just want to kill things and take their stuff. Well, sex and love are big driving forces in the real world, as well as literature and world mythology. It's why the ancient Greeks invaded Troy. It's why Camelot falls. It's why a pair of star-crossed lovers end up drinking poison.
It's why Luke Skywalker ends up snogging his sister.
Yeah, a bit weird really. But it's an easy plot device that can help drive your story. It can shape the motivations for why your characters are doing the things that they do.
Thinking about how your setting treats sex as well as sexuality, relationships, gender and what have you, this can help build the game world into something bigger and more complex and adds new dimensions and flavour to your campaign.
And of course, sex is funny, so it can add a lot of humour and lots of fun for your players if you include it.
For some of this, you will be freestyling it because there's not exactly a huge amount of books with a heavy sex or relationship theme to them.
Yeah, it's notably absent for such a large part of, you know, human experience. It is notably absent in most games.
There's a couple of indie games that do. So, for example, Girl X Boy is a game styled after Japanese romance computer games. So it's played as a game of trying to get yourself a girlfriend or boyfriend. Some games have an almost more pornographic slant, like Black Tokyo, which is hentai-infused, Tales of Gore, which has a gory and kink vibe.
We don't talk about gore.
We don't talk about gore, and I don't own any of these, although I do own Alpha Blue, which is a sort of Barbarella-y 1970s smutty sci-fi role-playing game.
There's Unknown Armies as well, which has a very different take on it.
Yeah, it does feature sex in one of its magical schools. It has strange methods of magic, and one of them is pornomancy, which is specifically a sex-based magic school by recreating sex from porn films. But you don't get to have loving sex. You can only gain your magical powers by having sex, recreating the porn scenes, preferably in the same locations and with the same people. It's not as useful or as pleasant as it sounds.
I mean, even if a game doesn't have explicit rules in the book, it can still be included with a little bit of imagination. And of course, some settings and genres will be a more natural fit to have romance or relationships. So anything that's set in like a high school or, you know, like a vampire game naturally lends itself to romance in a creepy way.
There's heavy sexual vibes in Dracula and the various spin-off media that have followed in its footsteps, right?
Yeah. And of course, Pendragon does have an explicit thing in it about finding a wife. And there's a space on the character sheet for your wife's name. It's very much expected.
Yeah. But a lot of gamers are probably... It's air through teeth time right now, folks. As sex and relationships often get dodged at the table.
Yeah, because of course, not everybody's going to be comfortable with it. And that is something that you need to establish pretty early on with your group, is everybody's comfort level in talking about these subjects in particular in front of other people could be something that they're dealing with in their personal life that they don't necessarily want to talk about, or if they're just going through a breakup, this might not be the best time. Yeah. They might genuinely lack experience or knowledge in that area and don't want to appear stupid, embarrass themselves in front of their friends. I mean, even something simple like marriage might be a bit of an uncomfortable topic for some players if they are maybe under a lot of pressure from their parents and they came to the game to escape all that. So it is something you're going to have to establish early on. How does everybody feel about it?
That said, I think it's important to note when we're talking about real world cultures, their attitudes towards sexuality, towards gender politics, towards relationships are often a very big part of how we'd understand them. If you think of, for example, Japan, Sweden, Saudi Arabia, Italy, you've probably already come up with some ideas in your head about what those cultures are like to do with their attitude towards sex and relationships and gender and what have you. Those elements are quite central building blocks in building a culture.
And of course, just because a culture like France has got a very sexually open and liberated attitude doesn't mean it can't still have a quite patriarchal attitude and certain things are tolerated and not tolerated. But this gives a rounded 3D world for your characters to play in.
Because there's a stereotype amongst a lot of people that cultures become more liberal almost like technological progression, like it just happens. Like everything in the old days is conservative and everything in the future is progressive. And that is not remotely how it works.
I mean, like, for example, we are still having the conversation in parts of the world whether homosexuality is some sort of mental disorder or whether it's a, you know, of course, it's a perfectly normal and natural thing. It's been documented across human history. But of course, in ancient Roman or Greek times, it was just accepted.
Basically, all men were expected to be bi, right? It was sort of expectational. You will marry a woman, but you'll fancy guys. That's just how it goes down.
And it was just cool. It was tolerated and it was fine. But here we are, hundreds of years later, and, you know, like...
But yeah, but the Greeks and the Romans are a great example of do not assume that the past is more socially conservative than now. And the inverse, don't necessarily assume your future is going to be like a glorious utopia. I mean, even now, a first world country like Japan has what we would consider slightly odd attitudes towards public displays of affection. It's not even like a gay thing, just anybody snogging in the middle of the street in Tokyo or Osaka, that would be considered a little bit of a faux pas.
But it does tell you something about that society. And of course, if you are thinking about historical settings as well, there are some things you're just going to have to address. So for example, there are lots of cultures in the real world that have what we would now call child marriages and child brides. Once upon a time, a 12 or 13 year old getting married was seen as normal and natural. In the game Pendragon, we did have to just make a decision
right
around the table about this.
Because the historical accurate version is just if a lady has gone through puberty, they were marriageable. But none of us wanted to play, let's be blunt, pedo nights.
Yeah, right? There was the ick factor that we had to just have a discussion about. We settled on 15.
Because it's younger than we would think is acceptable now, but not so young that we can't, like... stop, like, we can stop ourselves vomiting constantly at our player characters doing this. We can accept it as a cultural tweak.
Yeah, and I suppose when you're world building as well, you can think about how religion plays a part, like it does, plays a huge part in the real world. Sex and morality and religion can often get really tangled up with each other, for better or worse.
Yeah, so like with the real world example, when you look at the Greek gods and Zeus endlessly banging everything that moves.
Sometimes as a swan.
Sometimes disguised as his own daughter.
Yeah, they were... He got around.
But that says something about their expectations, right? About their priorities. And again, like some fantasy settings. Blue Rose, whose default game starting area of Aldous is very liberal. It has two gods, a spring god and a sun god, who are both male and are both in a relationship. It specifically said that like the word for being gay is lover of the dawn in their culture, because they go, oh, you are in a relationship like those two gods. We get it. It's fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so introducing something like that automatically tells you about something about the culture. It's going to tell you, your players, that if they are wanting to play a gay character or have a gay relationship, it's going to be perfectly normalized within the game.
That said, this is not an excuse to design a game world that satisfies all your weird kinks, okay? It's not okay in the middle of a normal D&D game to say, I've invented a magical new world for you to explore where everyone is and lives in harems with eight women and they all get dressed up sailors. Right, okay, Doug, this is not okay.
Yeah, again, this is why, yeah, gore is not okay. We're not allowed to have women in chains. I mean, unless everybody in the group thinks that's okay.
If everyone's turned up for the gory and role-playing game, that is their business. But if you've just turned up to play Warhammer and suddenly all Adeptus Sororitas warrior nuns are running around in bikinis, there's a case to say, right, James, I need to stop you there. Do you need to go and sort yourself out before we continue playing?
Another thing to think about is relationships. Is your game world going to include polyamorous relationships? Like, for example, taking it back to religion, if we had an alien species that had a god with six wives, maybe that will tell you something about this alien species and what they consider a normal relationship to look like. Will interracial relationships be tolerated? D&D's full of like half-elves, half-orcs. Are they accepted into either society, really?
Then when it comes to the topic of like sexual and gender politics, some cultures have jobs or roles that they consider are appropriate for a specific gender. And that can, even in our own Western history, that job bias has changed. Once upon a time, for example, working with computers was perceived as an offshoot of secretarial work and thusly perceived as a feminine role. And then as time went on, it got tumbled into a more kind of patriarchal role interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, that happens all the time. I mean, nerd culture's full of it. I mean, once upon a time, Star Trek was watched by housewives. It was a very much female fandom.
The big orchestrator of the campaign to keep Star Trek on air when it was being cancelled in the 60s was Joe Trimble, B-J-O, Joe Trimble, who the Bajorans are named after. I think her husband was involved as well. I don't know his name because he's not as important as her. She's probably the first big Star Trek fan ever.
Yeah, so thinking about sexual politics, sexual dynamics, how sexism might affect the culture, that's something to think about in your game world as well. Another thing is like, you know, long-term relationships. I mean, we, in our culture, you know, marriage was really less about love for a long time and more about combining wealth and property. So making sure that money in houses were passed down from parents to children in Western culture, the wife taking the husband's name was part of that.
But again, even without going to fantastical examples, in a lot of Spanish-speaking countries, everyone hyphenates, right? It's all...
Yeah, you take your mum and your dad's name.
So that immediately tells you a little something, and it makes it obvious when you look at a person's name, oh, they're from some sort of like Spanishy culture with a different interpretation.
Yeah, so there's nothing to stop you from saying that all the elves do that, or they specifically don't get married. They enter into, you know, established relationships for maybe 10, 20 years, and then, you know, they're very long-lived. They go off with somebody else.
I mean, I believe in D&D 3rd Ed, kobolds were given a background change that all kobold eggs were placed in a communal nursery. So they were raised by the whole tribe, and when they established what a kobold was good at, they would be given to an appropriate family to foster. So when we worked out the baby would be good as a shoemaker, we'd give it to the shoemaker family. But you didn't exactly look after your specific progeny. Now that immediately tells you something about how lineage and bloodline don't matter quite the same to that culture. So their attitude towards sex and relationships will be a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And again, some species could have biological reasons. Is it cats where you can get multiple kittens by different fathers at the same time?
What's the word for it? Hyperfecundity?
Hyperfecundity. It's a good word. If a species has that trait, that might change a lot of how they view things, like marriage, like bloodlines, like passing things down a father's line. if it's completely possible that somebody could give birth to 6 babies and they could come from multiple different fathers at the same time.
And of course, if we're talking about relationships, we need to talk about, for example, homosexual relationships. Again, it's inescapable. These people will exist in your game.
If they don't, something has gone very, very wrong.
If a player wants to play a gay or bisexual character, how are the rest of the characters in that game world going to respond to them? Is it just going to be normalised? I mean, a kind of traditional D&D setting's quite medieval. Will they be shunned and ostracised? And again, bearing in mind that you are playing with real human players, mind your language and think about it and make sure everybody's okay with it going in.
Because even something like Blue Rose, which has a very liberal, LGBT-friendly core game world, it has enemy empires, which are explicitly not, which are explicitly quite hardline and homophobic, for example. Your player group might not want to emphasize that element if you don't want to hear certain slur words or have the theme of gay people being rounded up by the evil necromancer. Or you might enjoy a plot where somebody says, you can't do that, you lesbian. Ow! My balls!
I mean, one game where I have played a non-straight character was Pendragon, which is, you know, Arthurian story.
And quite hard historical, comparatively speaking.
Yeah, and my character in the character creation rolled up. He had, was it something sort of dark secret or something?
You rolled a very low honour score, and you were initially, I don't get this,
why
how
would
does
a
this
knight
work?
Not have honour? What would it be about him that would mean he was within this society's eyes without honour? And I thought, what if he was gay?
And his father was explicitly established previously as being a really hardline, devout, paladin, Christian type. So it sort of fitted into this traditional gay story about, you know, being disowned by cruel parents.
So I just worked that into the story, you know, rather than going to court every winter to try and find a wife like the rest of the players were doing. My character had to desperately dodge it.
And he had that squire who he was very, very close to.
Yes, yes, very, very close to indeed.
And other elements of the LGBT alphabet soup should, of course, also be acknowledged. There are several real-world cultures that have transgender people mentioned in some capacity, two spirits or what have you. Your game world, whether you acknowledge it or not, your game world is probably going to have these people in it somewhere. It's up to you whether they're open or closed, whether it's a big deal or not a big deal.
Yeah, and I mean, historically, different cultures have treated transgender individuals as sort of semi-divine, almost, as being very almost godly in a way, or seen as very good luck. For example, the Hijra are invited to weddings as a blessing. But of course, you know, the conversations that we're currently having every day on Twitter would say otherwise about modern Western culture. So again, you've got to establish how your players feel about this. Is there any particular words or phrases that they just flat out do not want to hear? Again, a really simple conversation and listening to your players as you go along can take care of that.
Right, because like in our superhero game, we have a recurring villain whose specific gimmick is Ku Klux Klan member supervillain. And there is, for example, a non-straight player and a non-white player who quite enjoy this villain because the villain goes in a really stupid racist or sexist or homophobic rant.
And then we get to punch him in the face.
But it's also okay if somebody specifically said, I'm not really comfortable, we're dealing enough with racists in real life. That would be fine. As it happens, the non-white guy absolutely adores and specifically requests, can you bring him back so I can slam him in the face with a... Yeah.
Oh, endless fun. Endless fun. I mean, another thing, if you're going to include sex at some point, it's the world's oldest profession. Is your game going to include sex workers?
That's probably the one element that does pop up in a lot of like traditional D&D games, even if it's just a brief joke about I spend all my gold on ale and whores.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a word right there. Is that okay? How are you going to treat sex workers? Are you going to use that word? Or, I mean, there's a whole game about sex workers called Courtesans.
It's kind of 1800s a Georgian sex workers. It's actually got a little bit of a feminist vibe. We might do a elevator pitch on it in the future, but you compared it to the TV show Harlots.
Oh, very much so. If you've ever seen Harlots, you're basically playing Harlots the game. It's all corsets and heaving bosoms and intrigue, and it's amazing. We can't get our group interested in it primarily because of discomfort around the topic, which is totally okay. We just maybe need to look for a different game group.
Again, don't assume that every culture has the same hang-ups that your culture has about sex workers. Again, going back to the example of Romans. Roman brothels operated very openly. They had signs outside the door showing genitals so everyone could know what they were doing. The sex workers walked around wearing effectively price tags so that you didn't have to worry about the awkward haggling. You could just go, oh, she's definitely at my price range. Oh no, I can afford him. I can afford him. Let's get it going.
Are your players going to be okay with going to the tavern and then going to the brothel? Again, just have the conversation, have it openly, and it's better to get these things out of the way before something goes wrong. And of course, if your characters are having sex, you might need to think about contraception.
Now, there's another element where people may make some assumptions because they would assume at some point in the 1960s, the pill became commonplace, and before that, everybody was having babies 24/7. And that's sort of true, but not entirely. Famously, the classical cultures, the Romans had silphium, which was a plant that we think might have been some sort of contraceptive or similar.
Unfortunately, now completely extinct, so we'll never really know.
It went extinct during their time, which is part of the problem.
But, you know, pre-latex, people made condoms out of whale skin and goodness knows what.
And if you have technology and magic in your setting, then there may be specific magical charms that are sold that prevent conception. Or if you're trying to have a baby, maybe there's nanite injections you give yourself that, you know, keep yourself more fertile.
I mean, I'm thinking like a D&D world has different kinds of shops in it where it would be, you know, magical potions, magical weapons shop. There's nothing to stop you including the magical sex shop.
Or some of those things being included in just like when you go to the cleric to get healing, the cleric also sells effectively magical Viagra.
I'm just wondering, would it come in a little blue bottle?
Seems fair. Something else you might go to the cleric for, of course, is healing.
Yeah, if your character's been putting it around a bit.
I mean, you might just want to ignore that, but it is worth saying that in real historical world, a couple of particular sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis and gonorrhea were actually really serious, like proper kill or debilitated for your rest of your life serious.
And of course, I am thinking of a game that specifically mentions a sexually transmitted disease, and that's Vampire.
Right, because New Wave Requiem, which is a Vampire the Requiem book for the 1980s, talks about AIDS. It also makes some comparison to Malkavianism, which is a disease that spreads via the blood in Vampire the Requiem. It's got different rules in Vampire the Masquerade. Don't. I know. Don't write the comments. I know. Okay, I'm top level analysis, guys. Okay. But yeah, if your game world has either a direct sexually transmitted disease or an allegory for it, that's going to have effects on how things are perceived. Again, 1980s, recently on telly, and maybe also a bit upset because it's quite a moving It's a Sin TV show that talks about the effect that HIV had on the world.
Yeah, it's a roller coaster. It's traumatizing. Great, but you know, that a great way of showing how sex and relationships can again be the driving force for a story, and then what do the characters do next.
Now, when we talk about game worlds, it's worth saying most fantasy and science fiction game worlds do not just include humans, they include other species, and those other species do not necessarily work the same as we're going to work in sexuality. There's an awful lot of parts of human sexuality which are social but also genetic. There's things that you as a human being are and aren't into because from an evolutionary point of view it makes sense.
Yeah, and of course humans tend to only carry one baby at a time, so there's certain things that humans simply cannot do. They're not going to produce litters or get pregnant like you know, every week.
Right, because there's plenty of animals have children who can walk much faster. There's animals who lay 20 babies at a time. Those creatures could have evolved or been uplifted into sentient species. What impact does that have on the psychology of them?
And of course, if you're creating a race, it would be like an alien species, you can just, you know, reference real world examples. So
which are plenty weird enough.
Yeah, I mean, like anglerfish. I mean, goodness. I mean, the females are huge and the males are tiny little things that
Loads of them cling onto the side, don't they, of one anglerfish?
Yeah, and, you know, clownfish can just change sex.
Oh, that's right. If the woman dies...
Yeah, if the alpha female dies... one of the males will just change. If that species can just change their biological sex, how is that going to affect the culture? Maybe their god that they pray to is some kind of transgender or two-spirit type thing. Will their tech develop in a certain way because of that?
So again, maybe you have dwarfs who don't sexually reproduce. Maybe your dwarfs magically reproduce. Like Wonder Woman, they sculpt out of clay and breathe life into things. What does that mean about them?
I mean, if you're thinking about, again, like more sort of character-driven, maybe the different genders can have different traits associated with them. I'm thinking about Traveller. You've got the Aslan, who are like the sort of lions.
Yeah, that's right. The male and females have different roles they would follow, but it's not necessarily roles that make sense to humans.
So the males are tend to be sort of bigger and stronger, so they get like the military fighting roles, but the females are associated with trade, industry, science, brains, basically. I mean, I'm thinking like Starship Troopers. The pilots are all female.
Well, they think in the story world of Starship Troopers, they think that women just work better in the Space Navy and men just work better in the Mobile Infantry.
Yeah, so that's a really simple thing that you can bring into your game.
Now, just because your game world has sentient humanoid species does not mean that they have matching genitals. And whether or not they have matching genitals doesn't necessarily say anything about whether or not they are having sex.
I mean, I'm sure they'll give it a good old college try anyway, because, I mean, you know, have you met humans?
For example, in Babylon 5, the Centauri look to an outsider like human-shaped.
Oh, but they've got the... six.
They have six.
Yeah, they have six.
They have
six. I'm doing a waggly finger motion, and if you've seen Babylon 5, you'll know what I'm talking about.
And I basically have six appendages that they keep wrapped around themselves, and the ladies, I believe, have six orifices located in their backs. So it might be that an elf and a minotaur who love each other very much have logistic issues, but they make do.
And I mean, if you're going to include sex, it doesn't need to be just two.
I mean, lots of real-world species, again, do strange things with biological sex. To our eyes, used to two biological sexes and nothing else. Spoilers, it's not as simple as that. Your species could have three or more biological sexes. I believe the fifth edition of Traveller in its species generation system includes for up to six. And you could get in all kinds of weird questions about the reproduction and relationship situation of a species with more biological sexes than just male and female. What if you can't have a baby without three biological sexes present? What does that make dating like?
A lot more fun.
And it might be in your game world that certain species combos are or aren't acceptable. It might be that everyone thinks, oh yeah, half human, half Vulcan, that's fine. Half human, half Andorian, that's a bit weird. Or again, they might have certain things are taboo or fetishized. Maybe they have the attitude that being attracted to orcs is a kink. These things don't always necessarily have to be pleasant. As the real world has taught us, attitudes towards sex and gender are not always happy things.
Right, yeah. But I mean, speaking of happy, I said right at the start, sex is funny. So a lot of comedy can be had when you are role-playing these things, especially if the GM and the player have to flirt with each other. For example, there was once, again, going back to Pendragon, I was playing Sir Rodri, the fine upstanding Christian knight, and George was having to role-play his love interest, Lady Jenna, who was a teenage girl doing her best to throw herself at him while he was getting increasingly nervous. Now, I'm sure you can imagine how hilarious that was for the other players to watch this.
But again, probably want to have a discussion before
games kick off and again check in on people. This could be triggering for a variety of reasons, or they just might not find it comfortable. Might think it works better with some games than others. Some people might tell you, I'm happy to do a romance plot in a Star Trek game. I'm just not as comfortable doing it in this setting for whatever reason.
And yeah, and you might need to just consider the people around your game table. Is this going to be for everyone? Maybe not every player fits with every other player. Some people might just not see the point of this. They're just there to hit things and take their stuff.
I don't want to get all angsty woke here, but is also part of the problem that some people view playing games about relationships as, insert the quote marks in your head now, ladies and gentlemen, girly.
Yes, probably. But I think that also will probably come down to not lack of personal experience, but lack of personal comfort regarding it.
Comfort's a good word.
So that is something that you need to bear in mind. But like I said, bringing these elements in can really enhance your game world in terms of where your player characters are walking around and the people they're interacting with, the characters themselves, the races, the traits, the characteristics of them. You don't need to go too out there to make things much richer. And again, just look to our own world for inspiration. Look to different cultures, different mythologies. Look to different species in the animal kingdom. There was a really cute little comic I found. It's called Animal Lives by humancomics.com, which I'll put a little link up to. And it shows lots of different relationships within the animal kingdom that you could just use as a model if you were a little bit stuck. Like, I've got a couple in front of me here. Like, apparently cotton top tamarins, so the little monkeys. Apparently they have lots of different variations of families, but the most common family arrangement is one female with two males, which makes sense because tamarin females usually give birth to twins and it's the males who look after the young. So that's a really simple thing that you can bring into your game world, and it's instantly going to make things more interesting, a little bit more challenging for the role play, and yeah, just bring in something a bit more memorable.
So I think that's given you all something to think about. And we've managed to get through it all without even saying the word.
I know, we didn't even say or.
I was thinking really loudly though.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Dating apps haven't moved with the times. They cover all kinds of different sexualities, gender expressions, and all the many different background of Homo sapien. But what about you, the Homo superior? Just because your mutant gene activated when a radioactive spider bit you while you've been bombarded with cosmic rays doesn't mean you don't still want love. Announcing Super! The first dating app designed specifically for the superhuman community. Our profiles give you the usual space for pictures, age, gender, sexuality, and location, but we also offer a suite of choices to display exactly how your metahuman powers have expressed themselves and what sort of ability set you're looking for in a potential partner. Are you looking for the apocalyptic goddess of your dreams? Do you need a man who knows what the speed force is for? Or do you just want an orphaned gymnast who doesn't mind dyeing the hair and taking on the same name as the last five people you swiped on this app? Our ever-growing list of empowered eligible singletons can be sifted through with a simple interface. Swipe left to send them to Dating Arkham, and swipe right when you see someone who makes your bat signal light up. Non-powered superheroes and mundane allies are welcome. But for everyone's safety and well-being, we only permit direct messaging to start after the metahuman makes the first move. Our app comes in two versions, the free-to-use Uncanny Super, and also the premium service, Super Vibranium. Both have access to the same database of users, but upgrading to Vibranium unlocks the ability to say Excelsior to those people who really get your motherbox pinging with a marvellous like. Just listen to these real stories from actual Super users from across Earth 12.
I was fed up at dating water controllers. I didn't know how to make my tides ebb and flow. Or worse, cape chasers who just saw me as a pair of shells converted to lingerie. But now, with Super, I can get my hands on a real Atlantean's trident, if you know what I mean. Be the comfort of my own lagoon.
Finally, person app that lets me specify exactly the kind of Amazonian superwoman I need in my life. Must be 6'3", blonde, and a D cup, minimum. Earns less than me, obviously. Willing to cook and clean, must not be a feminist. I haven't found her yet, but I'm hopeful. So, which of you ladies is up to the challenge of letting me be super daddy?
So many people out there just get intimidated by the idea of a partner who uses gadgets. I'm looking for the strong and silent type with a fully stocked utility belt and abandonment issues to go with it. With super, I've got access to enough partners to keep me busy for all 9 of my lives. I hope at least one of them is man enough to show me their secret cave. Meow.
Yeah, so I'm a 2,500-year-old sorcerer supreme with singular tastes, and this is my muse, a 22-year-old goth runaway with mutant mimicry capabilities and crippling self-esteem issues. Say hello, kitten. We're looking to find someone open-minded enough to let us show them a world of arcane and erotic delights from within our windowless tower, where the laws of time, physics, and mortal sexual limits do not apply. No dudes, obviously.
Download Super from the Lexmart or Stark Play Store before the Infinity Gauntlet snap takes away half of our customer base. Again. Super! Never fly solo again.
Hey, George.
Yes, Ilsa?
Is that a rod of wonder in your pants, or are you just happy to see me?
I see that's the level we're going for this time.
Yes, so it's my turn to be the quiz mistress this time.
Quizinatrix?
Yeah, one of them. And I have chosen for our Valentine's episode a very suitable book. The Book of Erotic Fantasy.
Wow. Okay. Yes. So this is a book of some historical note. It was a supplement for 3rd Ed D&D that couldn't call itself a supplement for 3rd Ed D&D because Wizards of the Coast changed the rules of the D20 license just before this book came out, basically to prevent books with like bums and kissing and that getting the D20 license.
Yeah, so this is presented under the Open Gaming License, so it's fully compatible with 3rd Ed D&D, it just can't say that. And to be honest, even though the subject matter is sexy, there are boobs in it, I would say the content is much tamer than other, you know, officially licensed stuff. Like, the Book of Veiled Darkness is in its own little class.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think there's two interesting things about this. The first is that one of the writers, Gwendolyn F.M. Kestrel, wrote a bunch of, like, for want of a better word, real D&D books. She wrote multiple books for 3rd Ed and 3.5 D&D, like, and not just random sideways books. She wrote some relatively big titles. I'm pretty sure she does the Planar Handbook, for example, and I think she has some work on Eberron. Also, some of the reputation this book has more comes from other things people have written about D&D and sex. I think this book itself, like you say, it's still adult, but I wouldn't say it's immature exactly.
Well, no, it actually takes a very responsible approach about handling this topic. So, for example, it advises if you're going to include sex in your game, you should set a rating so players know what to expect and what they feel comfortable with. So, is this going to be a PG rating? Is it going to be an 18? It talks about managing consent between characters and NPCs. It talks about, in a world where magic is possible, being mindful that you're not straying into slightly dodgy territories about consent. Yeah, and overall it handles these topics in quite a mature way. The edition that I'm using for this quiz came out in 2006, so it's the second printing. The only negative I would say, again, it's 2006, it's got a very binary approach to gender. That wasn't part of the wider conversation back then.
No, that's, I think we should remember some of the stuff like trans and non-binary and intersex and what have you. These weren't really as big discussion points in 2006.
I imagine this is just an oversight. It wasn't done on purpose. The only thing that might be off-putting to some readers is instead of the usual pencil artwork in the D&D books of the time, it features colour photographs of real models, and there is full frontal nudity.
There's orc nip-nops, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, I mean, the photos are really pretty. They've got a slight sort of dreamlike quality. They're not pornographic in any way, but, you know, that's something to bear in mind if you did decide to pick this book up. And I should mention as well, another writer, Duncan Scott, was involved in this, and the book's published by Arthouse Inc., so that's a subsidiary of White Wolf.
I, for so long, thought it was Arthouse. It took me ages to realise that it was two words.
Arthouse.
Yeah, I know that now,
think
Ilsa.
Lady Gaga.
Yes, I didn't know Lady Gaga in 2006, Ilsa. I had no frame of reference. Anyway, what kind of quiz could we possibly do about the book of photographic nip-nops?
So, I have taken some lines from the book and replaced a word or phrase with another word or phrase. So you, George, and anyone playing along at home needs to identify which word or phrase looks more out of place than Mary Whitehouse at an orgy, and tell me what should actually go in that place.
More so than our previous quiz in this format with the PHB, this is not a book that I've read very often. It's not a book I've read recently, so this ought to be an experience. So let's go.
Okay, question number one. Of the humanoid races, the crankies tend to be the most diverse sexually. Heterosexuality, homosexuality, monogamy, promiscuity, single partner, multi-partner, penetrating, manual, oral, anal, rough, gentle, committed, casual, and more. The crankies' sexuality is all-encompassing.
Okay, so I don't think 1970s Leighton Children's Entertainment duo The Crankies were referred to in the Book of Erotic Fantasy, Ilsa.
They are not.
Although they should have been, because we found out some stuff about them later on, let me tell you.
Anyone who doesn't know who The Crankies are, do a little Google image search, then...
Just read the Wikipedia page.
You'll enjoy it. Have a laugh.
At a stab, Ilsa, is The Crankies a substitute for... humanity.
I'll give you that. Humans. So it's human sexuality is all encompassing.
We are the slappers of the fantasy world.
So this book gives pretty detailed descriptions of all the different player character races, their approach to love and sex, as well as pregnancy and childbirth. For example, apparently elves as a species view the concept of eternal love as one of the greatest hoaxes of the universe, and gnoll packs are matriarchal and follow similar mating habits as hyenas, with stronger, tougher females dominating the slightly weaker males.
I seem to recall there's a bit in it about goblins and them having an attitude of make babies, make as many babies as possible. Goblins die so often, we need more babies.
But yeah, humans will do anything, basically. Yeah. Question number two. An Aristasian-style matriarchy may exist where women play the dominant role in society and lesbian relationships are the norm, with men used only for procreation.
That sentence doesn't sound incorrect.
I mean, it's not. But can you identify the word that probably isn't in a book that's, you know, part of the wider D&D universe?
Is it Aristasian? Is Aristasian the incorrect word?
It is.
Okay, so this is a bit of an obscure one again. Did I use this as inspiration for D&D plot once? The Aristasians is one that were the cult that believed that the only two genders were brunette and blonde.
I think they'd call themselves a subculture rather than a cult.
Alternative ideology.
Yeah, so it's...
kinky lesbian alternative ideology.
So it essentially imagines a country in another world where there are no men. There's two sexes, the brunettes who are strong and adventurous, the blondes who are subservient and more spiritual. The Aristasians employ corporal punishment for disciplinary purposes. The most prominent member was Marianne Martindale, and there's a documentary about her I'm sure you can find online. As well as being a writer and columnist, she was also a creator of video games, and she was part of a group that created Bugsy and Jack the Ripper, which was a text adventure video game, the first one to be given an 18 rating.
Wow, okay, I didn't know the computer game part, but yes, I did know about the alternative ideology, and it's a bit weird. So there's somebody else who has principally lesbian relationships with men used only for mating. I'm going to guess, knowing what I know about D&D, it's this drow stroke dark elves.
Nope. Amazonian.
Amazonian. That feels a little bit, like, you know, bit too close to the bone, doesn't it? That feels a little bit too anvilicious, but all right, fair enough.
Another fact about Marianne Martindale, as well as being just a general all-round English eccentric, she ran a school, in air quotes, where young ladies could come to be disciplined, and published a variety of books including The Female Disciplinary Manual, Disciplined Ladies and Other Stories, and The District Governess. The whole subculture has kind of moved online now, so if you go to aristasiacentral.com and just have fun, it's a real thing. Question number 3. Instagram filter. Target perceives others as having a +4 bonus to appearance.
Okay. Predating the founding of Instagram, we have successfully spotted the wrong word, ladies and gentlemen. Here's what I think. I think that Third Ed D&D had a bunch of spells that were all animal named for stat boost, like Bull's Strength, like Cat's Grace. I reckon this is an appearance boosting equivalent. So I think it's going to be an animal something. I'm going to pick an animal that is associated with beauty and just take a punt here. I'm going to go Peacock's Beauty.
It's incorrect, but I see how you got there. It is indeed two words, and they are ale goggles.
Oh, mine was a lot classier.
So remember, it's perceiving others have a +4 bonus.
Right.
So you can cast it on somebody. It's a bard spell, so it's saving throw against will.
There probably is a peacock, and it's probably a total. It's a different spell in the book.
Yeah.
Okay, right.
Listen to the question, George.
No, it's not going so good, guys.
I want to take my jumper off and do it.
Getting hot in here.
So take off all your clothes. Let's not put that bit in.
Oh, of course not. It's going in.
Okay. Question 4. On the whole, the size of a character's genitals, breasts, or other physical features have no bearing in terms of sexual performance. Remind players that being endowed in such a way does not give a bonus. If he wants his character to be good in bed, tell him to purchase a Hitachi.
Okay! Is it... I think this book gives rules for like a skill for sex. So is it something like purchase ranks in sex craft or something like that? Or performance sex?
I'm going to give you that. It's ranks in perform. There is actually a whole table to quantify your sexual performance and the rewards that it'll give you. But, you know, it's just good advice in general, I think.
In the size of the dice, it's what you roll with it.
Question 5. Black withering. A magically resistant disease. With spell resistance 12 against cure or remove disease spells, it causes genitalia to blacken, rot, and finally sprout wings and fly away.
I mean, in D&D context, that's not entirely impossible. Is it that rather than sprouting wings and fly away, it just like withers away and falls off?
It does fall off. Which, you know, if that doesn't promote safe sex, I don't know what would.
Does it specify that it's only male genitalia that wither and fall off?
It doesn't. It just says causes genitalia to blacken, rot and finally fall off. There are some other sexually transmitted diseases, including azure balls that only affects males.
See how that
goes. Yeah, we see how that goes. It's not a real thing.
I seem to recall it mentions mummy rot as well.
Yeah, mummy rot and lycanthropy can now be transmitted sexually as well. So wrap it up. Number 6. Giants sometimes breed with humanoids or monstrous humanoids. Those with a touch of giant blood in their bloodlines use the Hagrid template.
Okay, assuming that there was no lawyers for Joanne getting involved here, let's say that rather than the Hagrid template, it is the half-giant template, or giant-blooded.
It's not half, because they've got giant blood in their bloodlines. It's the giant-born template. I'm going to give you half a point for that, though, because you're on the right track. Interestingly, page 50 has a table about... interspecies crossbreeding.
This is one of the things I actually found the most useful in the whole book, if I'm going to be honest.
So it's basically what species can crossbreed with what other species. So, for example, if we look at humans, they cannot crossbreed with bugbears, but they can crossbreed with celestials, dragons, and dryads. Interestingly, dwarves can't crossbreed with most of the species. They cannot crossbreed with humans or halflings or orcs. They can crossbreed with nymphs and fiends. And the one that I can't entirely get my head around, the species that can crossbreed with the most other species, including ogres, giants, and dragons, Sprites can apparently have babies with ogres.
That's the magic of lemon and lime fizz, Ailsa. Sprite.
Ah! I was going to say it's some hot skitty on Waylord action. And just the mental image, I just
don't,
can't...
No, get it, banish it.
And bugbears! Sprites and... No, right, I'm just putting the book away. Number 7. Animal nitrate. You exude an undeniable yet feral personality that others find both intoxicating and threatening. You gain a +2 bonus on bluff, diplomacy and intimidation checks.
Now, there are not enough role-playing games that feature references to suede. I think everybody who is alive in 90s Britain can accept that. I'm going to say it right now. Suede and Pulp, substantially better than Oasis and Blur. I don't care if you guys stop following me because of that. I'm not editing this out. I'm drawing a line in the sand, and this is my line in the sand.
Oh no, Oasis can defenestrate themselves.
I realise that's not a popular opinion, though, for everyone else of our generation. It's an animal magnetism.
It is animal magnetism. Well done. So that is a feat that is included in this book. This book introduces some new feats, including instant recovery. Sure, you don't need me to draw you a picture there. Limber. And sexual training, which gives you a +2 con to sustaining sexual acts.
Sexual training? Did you go to a college? Do they do, like, night classes?
Oh, it's like Open University these days. It's all online.
I have seen the Open University professors. They probably would.
Number 8. Sting needs sex to renew his spells. George is just giving me a face. Sting needs sex to renew his spells.
Okay. Right. Okay.
Think logically.
I'm thinking logically. I'm assuming in context this comes from like a class or prestige class.
It is.
And it's like a description of how they get their spells back. But it's not just going to be called the sex wizard, is it? It's going to have a name that's a little bit fancier. And my brain has just suddenly combined neurons and realised, is it Tantrist?
It is Tantrist. So Tantrists are a new class introduced in this book. They metamorphose sexual energy into magical power. And they inscribe spells onto their body through scarification so they themselves become a living spellbook. Sting, of course, as well as being a musician, known for his... sexual training. Number 9. Voyeuristic seers most often come from the ranks of Tory MPs.
There's nothing wrong with that sentence.
No.
That sentence is completely correct.
Oh, maybe I forgot to change this one.
Oh, right. Okay. Voyeuristic seers often come from the ranks of... It's okay. Is it a class title by any chance?
It's a prestige class.
No, I mean, I'm assuming Tory MPs is the wrong word. It's going to tell me that they usually come from a particular class.
Mm-hmm.
Voyeuristic seers usually come from... I'm going to take a punt at... I'm torn between sorcerers and bards, ladies and gentlemen. So I'm going to jump at sorcerer.
Incorrect. Correct answer is wizards.
Wizards? With their constitution... Oh no, voyeuristic. They don't need a high constitution score for that. They'll be fine.
Yeah, so it's basically a prestige class that allows for superior scrying, so you can become a peeping Tom.
That's not okay.
It's not. And the very last one is also not okay. Carry on up the dungeon. This cantrip is popular amongst apprentices who use it to untie the blouses of maids or lift the skirts of female classmates.
Okay, again, for those of you that aren't British, those of you who are American or Mexican or Japanese, whatever listeners, I'm so sorry. I'm going to have to explain that carry-on films are a series of 50s to 70s, I think, British comedies that were filled with lots of innuendo, a very specific British sort of wholesome filth.
Yeah, sort of family-friendly naughtiness and cheekiness. And there was a whole range of them, like Carry On Sergeant, Carry On Nurse, Carry On Up the Jungle, that follow a similar naming theme.
And we should say, one of the most famous scenes for a Carry On film is one where recently passed actress Barbara Windsor is doing exercise, and she exercises so hard that her bra pops off.
This is what passes for comedy in this country.
It was a different era. Okay, so it's a spell for undoing bra straps, basically.
Would you like a clue?
I'll take a clue.
So this is not a new spell. This is in a section called New Kinks with Old Spells.
Okay, then I can take a punt at this. It's Mage Hand.
It's Mage Hand! That's right. So for this purpose, Mage Hand has been changed to, yeah, undo bra straps. The book does note that this spell is strongly discouraged, and apparently anyone caught abusing the spell is punished, but almost every wizard's given a go when they were young.
And with that, I feel dirty and soiled. I am also in possession of 6.5 points.
Not bad, not bad. If you've still got time, I have a bonus round.
Okay,
you can claw back some extra points here.
Bonus round, okay.
Okay, so same thing. So I've just replaced a word or phrase. Ilsa uses sex as one of her tools. She takes what she wants from those within her power. Ilsa is most definitely evil, but she plays by the rules.
I assume it's that she doesn't play by the rules. I can't see what else could possibly be incorrect about that sentence. it's going to be a D&D deity.
So are we to assume that Ilsa is the incorrect word?
If I had to take a punt, it would be that Ilsa is the incorrect word. So I'm going to guess it's referring to... It's got to be something that could be talked about in the open game license. So it can't be, like, Lolth, because the gods wouldn't be included, I think, as part of the open game license.
I'll read the last part to you again. Ilsa is most definitely evil, but she plays by the rules.
I got nothing.
I'm going to give you half a point. It's a lawful evil character.
Oh, man!
Sorry. And final bonus round. Despite their reputation as curmudgeons, Georges are energetic lovers, known for their prolonged sexual sessions, which can last for a full day or more.
Now, I feel resentful about this because I think this is dwarf.
Yes!
I am a perfectly normal height of 5'10".
I'm sorry.
Okay, well, we've learned lots of things. We've learned about the Book of Erotic Fantasy.
And that George can last a full day or more.
And we've learnt that we shouldn't let Ilsa do the quiz section.
So if you were playing along at home, let us know how you did. And maybe I'll be allowed to host another quiz again in the future.
You won't.
Aww. That's the end of our Valentine's episode. If it made your heart skip a beat and fail your saving throw on Charm Person, then why not share the love by hitting the subscribe button or leave us a review?
As always, you can send us love letters by email, tilldicepodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram @tilldicepodcast, but don't DM us at 3 a.m. saying, hey, you up, all right?
Our theme tune is Funny Adventures by Winnie the Moog, and additional music this episode was Funk Game Loop by Kevin MacLeod and Successful Connections in a Technological World by Music L Files. They're all used under Creative Commons Attribution License. And of course, our logo was created by Neil Slorens. You can find him at Art by Neil Slorens.
See you all next time for a slightly more safe for work endeavour.
Bye!